Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on data networking coming from Orlando in Florida. Packet Pushers is a podcast where real engineers get together to talk about networking in a completely nerdy mode. Broadcasting today from the social media clubhouse at Cisco Live in 2013, where we're surrounded with a bunch of people who've managed to convince their employers to dip into their pockets and cough up the bucks to ship them out to Orlando to hear and feed at the great teat of information that is Cisco Live, where we suckle pure Kool-Aid from the mothership. Excited? Of course you are. When real engineers get together to talk nerdy, we don't have to apologize for being who we are, for waving our hands at the virtual whiteboard and pretending that we know what this is about. As always, I'm Greg Farrow. You could probably find me on my blog at Ethereal Mind or even on the Twitter as at Ethereal Mind, but mostly you want to hear from Mr. EC Banks.
Mr. EC Banks, at EC Banks on the Twitter. Here at Cisco Live, where it's hot and humid and Florida and all that kind of stuff. Hooray. Yeah. But we're in the air-conditioned comfort, and I found it very annoying that you thought this heat was just reminded you of home and it was great.
It's lush. It's absolutely lush. There's nothing like a bit of swamp ass to lift your day.
I will say, it's very Brisbane out there.
It is.
It's very Brisbane.
That's right. Brisvegas, which is where I grew up, is same sort of, you know, humidity and the same sort of temperature. It's all good.
Yeah. And that other voice was that of Cooper Lee, who we've been trying to get on the show forever for whatever reason. It hasn't worked out.
It's taken a while, yeah. We've tried time zones. I'm now in a much easier time zone, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm now relocated to the Bay Area. I work in Silicon Valley for a large company there. I'm an operations engineer. You can find me on Twitter at Cooper Lee's.
Awesome. Also with us is Lauren Malhoit.
Yeah, hi, I'm Lauren Malhoit. I'm a post-sales implementation engineer and residing in the Midwest in Indianapolis. And you can find me on Twitter at Malhoit, M-A-L-H-O-I-T.
Lauren publishes a podcast.
Well, I didn't want to shameless self-plug on your podcast.
Do it. Shameless. Self-plug. Go for it.
Because
right.
We're expecting to come on your show.
And make men wear wigs on my show, so be ready for that. But yes, I started a podcast back in January called Adapting IT, and I essentially interview women who are in and around the IT field, and so far it's been really great, and the numbers are going up every month, so I appreciate all the support.
We need to hear women's voices in IT, so it's great that you've taken the time to speak out and to share that sort of stuff. And so it's really valuable.
Thank you very much.
Strongly agree. Then another voice who's been on the show before a number of times is Colin McNamara.
Hi, I'm Colin McNamara, at Colin McNamara on Twitter. I blog at colinmcnamara.com. My main focuses are contributor to OpenStack, work a lot in the community around that, as well as actually manage an organization in my own work, which is helping transform our engineering staff from systems and network integration to having software skills and the capability to exist in the new world.
Yeah, so Colin's kind of on the leading edge of what a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, where software and software-defined networking is going to change really how we do networking. It's not going to be this command line interface and one device at a time kind of thing. It's going to be automated. It's going to be orchestrated. It's going to be software-defined. Yeah, that's where things are headed, and Colin's right in the front lines of that. So thank you for coming on the show, Colin.
Thanks for having me.
Greg, did you want to kick off the topics today in this community show?
No, I think you should do it.
Well, you have the notebook. I can't see what you got in front of you.
Well, that's a good part. That was a good trick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Well done.
I guess one of the topics that we've actually had here over the – we've actually recorded a couple of shows while we're at Cisco Live so far, and this whole automation, orchestration, Cisco Live, this process of DevOps-ing in the network has been really, really big. So what I want to kick off is a discussion that Lauren wanted to lead out on, which was around Cisco One and OpenStack, and what's your experiences there?
Well, you know, I've just kind of gotten into it, and mostly I've gotten into OpenStack using really scripted installs for my home lab and reviewing some of the cookbooks that are coming out. And so I'm just trying to dive in as quickly as possible. But I've noticed there are several sessions here at Cisco Live around OpenStack, and Cisco One is obviously their open network environment initiative, which was, you know, big in quantum, but which is now called Neutron, I believe, as of That's yesterday. Correct. So, I don't know. I'd like to hear from the rest of you who know way more about OpenStack, but hopefully I can contribute a little bit from what I've learned.
So I guess the background there is Cisco ONE, or Open Network Environment. It consists of two parts. There's the 1PK, which is the APIs in the networking assets. So Cisco, at Cisco Live last year, when we were in San Diego, we covered that. We spent there's a bunch of podcasts in the Priority Queue feed where we dive into the 1PK announcement. And the 1PK is a programmer's kit, or programmer's, you know, ONEPK, 1PK is programmer's kit, which allows – and as Cisco's been progressively delivering on the 1PK vision over the last year, so some software is further along than others. Some software in some like iOS SX or iOS traditional, you know, the pure iOS X, they may never get 1PK extensions because the software just may never be backported into those code bases. Maybe, maybe not, right? But we know that iOS XR has it, CRS will have it, NXOS will have it in the near future. So the first part to enable all of this capability is to understand which platforms and which software has the 1PK capabilities. Now, 1PK is a group of APIs that gives you access to all of the Cisco features. That could be, and they're just Cisco specific, so they're all proprietary to Cisco, which is a beef that I have, right? So
it's not so open.
Not so open, and not so – what we potentially would like to have is the same API set from all the vendors. But
well yeah, I mean, Cisco would make the point that the APIs they're writing are because they take very it writes to all the unique capabilities of their hardware. In other words, the APIs they're writing might not be portable to another platform because, hey, we wrote it for our stuff because our stuff's magic.
That being said, I'm trying to skirt around some early access maybe experiences with this. Yeah. Some of the earlier implementations may not be on Cisco ASICs. Right. And so when you look at it, you know, there's a value in, you know, kind of the, my world, you might say, or the world my world's evolving into decoupling the network functions from the operating system, from the operating itself, from the hardware itself. And, you know, that's really where I see Cisco One being implemented. I actually have a customer going live, a SaaS customer is using it integrated with their applications. That's kind of neat because it allows you to integrate, basically trigger an application to make true network applications. Now, absolutely to your point, there's some neat stuff you can do, and it's not the hardware, but if you look at, you know, Cisco's made network operating systems for years. Very complex network operating systems and a couple of different forks.
Where Cisco is pushing this is they're saying all their uniqueness is going to be 1PK, and then there's going to be the standard baseline that pretty much all vendors are going to have. You know, your VLAN configuring, you know, your port speeds, all that kind of stuff is going to be there in an open standard kind of way.
Well, then open. So if you look at the open standards, open daylight.
Open daylight. That's
open daylight,
that's
foundation. Yep. Cisco and Big Switch both. It's kind of a little contention about which code was going to get inserted in the middleware. Cisco One code got inserted, and so specific to OpenStack, we're actually seeing is now not former Quantum, now Neutron, is where your applications request policy. I need this virtual machine to talk to this virtual machine or instance in the cloud slang, and that is then interpreted with a plugin to Open Daylight. Which then is, in effect, a network compiler, which takes a look at the capabilities of your software, your hardware underneath, and pushes down that policy. And it's through the Cisco code. Now, Cisco is, and I'm trying to skirt around from what I've seen publicly, really the vision is that all the neat things you can do with a router, with a switch, is that now you start licensing and paying for these virtualized functions, which integrate into this more cohesive orchestration layer.
Yeah. So the unique thing about 1PK, just to break that down a little bit more granularity, is 1PK allows you to do things like add a static route via an API, to add a MAC address, a filter, a firewall rule, an access list. It allows you to redistribute routes from OSPF to BGP. So if you think about that for a minute, instead of going into the CLI and typing it in, you actually have an API with a roll-forward, roll-back mechanism. So you can punch it in, do a redistribution from OSPF to BGP, and then have an application come back 4 hours later and rip it out, right? Because that's what you want to be able to do. That's what 1PK enables. The question then is what software applications can do with those exposed features.
That's
because
right.
Cisco has hundreds and hundreds of its features in its routers, QoS, MAC address filtering list, CLSW,
funny stuff.
You know, all those types of tools. but they've never been exposed over an API. So the best we've had up until now is TCL, where you write TCL scripts on the box, which is kind of clunky. It's not rich. It's not reliable.
Best, yeah.
Well, if you look at right now, I'm looking at the RESTful API from the open source side, stuff that made it into OpenDaylight. It's flow programmer, host tracking, monitoring, slice managing, static routing, statistics pool, pushing subnets, switch management, basic topology interrogation, right?
So that's the first pass.
Yeah.
And then the API, the 1PK will grow then to add in other features as time goes by.
Yeah. And that roughly maps into OpenFlow 1.0, roughly.
Yeah. I guess, you know, at the end of the day, networking primitives remain – there's fundamentals. It has to be a VLAN, has to be a port, has to be a path, right?
Mm-hmm. But it has to today. Today.
So where are we with 1PK, though, right now? I mean, it's not ready or parts of it are...
It's been beta for a year, right?
Limited to release right now.
Yeah.
So there are people in production and general availability is coming within the next couple weeks.
Okay.
From my understanding.
So you can start with the early versions. You can start writing code against it. Mm-hmm. So, but again, you have to have the right hardware platforms that support 1PK and have a roadmap. So for people to get into it today, if you were making a choice to implement it in your organization, what would I be thinking about? I'd be thinking, am I got the right hardware in my network and am I going to be buying the right hardware? Mm-hmm. So I'd have to go and approach my Cisco account manager and ask him to give me a pre-brief on the roadmap for 1PK and which products are going to get it. So, for example, there's products being announced here at Cisco Live this week. They won't have it until mid to late next year. So you'll need to do some careful evaluation. If you think 1PK is something that you want, that'll force you down the paths of, say, the ISR routers, the ASR 1000s, for example, have it, the 9000s.
Nexus 3500s.
Yeah, I'll add something here. If you're not sure if you want it or not, I'm going to guess you probably don't.
Yeah.
If you want it today, if you want that kind of network programmability today, you're probably a company that is very forward-thinking about how you're trying to manage your environment or a specific application you're trying to deploy, or you got some kind of a specific problem to solve. You already know what it is. It's pretty well defined to you, and you understand how network programmability is going to resolve that issue for you.
Well, and specifically, you have a problem which most likely cannot be solved using classic distributed systems. It's the problem solved for the problem I referred to earlier is absolutely it's an integrated network application operating system.
Yeah.
So just for the people listening at home, distributed operating systems is where we talk about network. If you have a network of 100 switches in a data center, you've got 100 switches acting as a single unit, and that's a distributed application. However, what we want to be able to do is to say instead of, and that the distributed application part is actually quite complex because what one switch does, it has to communicate to all the others so that they can become coherent. Mm-hmm. So that's like when you add a server to the network at a switching layer, the MAC address has to be propagated across from all the others, and we do that using a flooding mechanism, and that's how we can create a distributed database. It's a really crude way, right? We flood.
Brute force.
It's brute force, right? Yeah. Basically brute
There's
force.
Nothing elegant about that.
You know, and it's vulnerable to loops. So, and any distributed system is always today built on eventual consistency. So that is if one switch changes, a new MAC address is inserted, or if an interface goes down, it will take time for the data to propagate across the distributed fabric until it reconverges on a new state, until it reaches steady state again. And that's the disadvantage of a distributed system. A centralized system comes down to the concept that each of those 100 theoretical 100 switches communicates to a central location, and that's where controller-based networking comes in. And the controller would then be able to program into each of the 100 devices, theoretically at a much better time frame and a more controlled way. So, for example, if you figure that you want to add a MAC address, you might want to add it to where the server – so when you add a new VM and that MAC address has to be added, you would add it to this switch and then add it to the ones along – you'd work out an optimal path for the distribution of information and then propagate that across the network. It might be it's more effective to actually program the MAC address from the other side of the network back towards the source instead of flooding it from source to destination. It just might mathematically be more efficient, right? But we've never been able to do that before. And having that single point of that controller changes the whole paradigm of networking. Now, one thing about controller networking is that it works in the data center because there's walls. The system is what's called a bound problem statement because the walls of the data center is where the problem is bound. Right. And it doesn't controller-based networking works less well in the WAN because the problem space is infinite.
Cooper, do you disagree with that? Or?
Well, I'm just thinking, like, today's data centers, if you, I believe if you build a data center right, you're going to have a mirror image of it somewhere else, at least, if not more. You know, you can't just have that one data center anymore if you want high availability. That's all I was going to say there. But I agree with everything else you said.
Yeah. The data center is rigidly controlled space.
Yeah,
so we can do things inside the data center that we can't do in the WAN. This has come back to the discussion around that I have with people is, when are we going to see SDN in the WAN? Well, the answer is yes, we will, but it's a different problem. We could focus on the data center and solve it there, prove the technology, and then we could start to adapt it for use.
Well, I think what you bring in is there's two different problem statements.
I think the data center is going to be where you're more app-focused with the APIs. And as you just said, the core will be more real-time monitoring and getting more efficiency on a cheaper device out in the core.
Yeah. I know like one of the things that I deal with every day is continuous delivery systems, right? So when you're making applications, there's a shift from it's called SDLC, software delivery lifecycle. So software design.
Software defined lifecycle.
Yes, no, it's actually not.
And here I was thinking of synchronous data link controllers.
So SDLC. So everyone on the podcast, you have to bear with me. I'm a West Coast or an East Coast in the morning, and it's killing me. But SDLC would take forever to make your code. You would end up with non-functioning, non-releasable code until a couple weeks before release. It would take 12 to 24 months to release. Continuous integration delivery tools. You're always releasing working code. You generally release every 2 to 4 weeks. The thing is that if you think of what is integrated with your application now, your firewall, your load balancer, your routers, your security group, and that to get to the point where you're doing 10 to 20, 30 or 40 releases a day, that you have to integrate your network applications with these software delivery mechanisms. And in the data center, SDN or software controlled network infrastructure is the only way of doing it.
I want to follow up on something that it's come up a few different times here, which is that of commodity hardware, cheap hardware in the core, simplified hardware in the core. And I bring that up in the context of we're at Cisco Live. We're sitting here talking. We're in the belly of the beast of a provider that doesn't want to sell you commodity hardware. They want to sell you a Cisco branded, feature rich, custom ASIC designed box that does magical things. Mm-hmm. Comes with its own unicorn and so on and so on. But yet, one of the recurring themes of SDN and why it is supposedly so wonderful is it's going to enable, a white box approach or a bare metal switch to load some kind of a generic operating system and do some defined subset of things as opposed to this rich feature laden expensive kind of box. Cisco, I think is going to position themselves necessarily. And I think we kind of seen this with 1PK. Our hardware and all the cool things it does is a differentiator for us. And you really don't want to be buying commodity hardware because I think that for business for them, that would be a bad thing. Do you guys see that in your networks that you're dealing with, the commodity hardware is a desirable thing and this is where things are truly going to head?
I'm going to let Cooper answer this one first. I think he has an interesting perspective, then I'll follow up.
Yeah, so I don't work in the real world anymore, so where we are, we're just after efficiency and whatnot. So, but in the real world, it's very different. People want stuff that they're more familiar with. This whole SDN thing just scares people, I believe.
If you look at the Nasir guys, which are old 1000B team, and a couple of brilliant scientists, get acquired by VMware, who has a – if you think of the distributed vSwitch as a very complicated thing. It takes commodity hardware in commodity Intel-based servers across a widely diverse networking platform and allows a Microsoft admin to create a complicated, high-functioning network.
Yep. So you're talking about overlay networking.
Well, I mean, but more than overlay networking.
Yeah.
Features, functions, manageability, standards implementation.
Yeah.
Right? That is – and if you think about it, that's actually – it's a good thing. And there's value to that. I think that there is this push to commoditization of networking.
So I'm going to take two points. I think I'll just jump in here. I wanted to catch back with Ethan. We talked about silicon commoditization and the idea that merchant silicon is going to become a commodity. One of the things to point out about Cisco is that Cisco is big enough to be a commodity silicon provider. So
actually, IBM is a commodity silicon provider for Cisco.
Yes.
They contract IBM's fabs.
Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that Cisco, even as the process of commoditization happens and we see the rise of the Broadcoms and the Marvels and the Fulcrums or Intel, right?
Yeah.
Cisco can be the fourth provider because Cisco is a big enough company to be silicon manufacturing.
Pause for a moment on that. They have an install base. So that's where 1PK comes in.
Yep.
As Cisco takes the software and exposes the routing, it rips the routing daemons off, right? And so you're left with a hook that you can control. The reality is that people have Cisco stuff everywhere.
Yes.
Right? It's already installed, and with a simple software upgrade.
Customers have the relationship, and CIOs have trust, and there's a whole bunch of...
You're suggesting that based on sheer volume, a custom ASIC built by Cisco is effectively commodity hardware?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And Intel, by the way,
that's kind of a point I didn't pick up. I only realized this in recent days, and I've sort of been mulling it over. Every time I pop down on the toilet, it keeps coming back.
Yeah.
You know.
So how does Cisco? Well, now here's
that's definitely what I think about when I'm on the job. Cisco ASICs, yeah.
Wow. And here's Greg.
I don't know what those two things put together.
This is what happens when you put two Aussies in a room.
Is that your funnel?
I think that's a really interesting point, Greg, because I've been thinking about it. I haven't been thinking about it that way. I've been thinking about it the other way. These guys that are making an off the shelf chipset, you can just stick it in a switch and off you go. Arista, for example, Pika 8, and a bunch of other ones.
They branded chipset. Arista does not make chipsets.
No, right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Said pull off the shelf.
Oh, sorry.
Right.
Cisco's got four chassis switches.
Mm-hmm.
They've got the 4500, the 6500, the Nexus 7000.
Something new.
4500, 6500, Nexus 7000, Nexus 6000. Right?
All chassis of various kinds.
All chassis of various flavors.
Yeah.
Is that Cisco, as you say, building multiple silicons and then offsetting the risk of one against the other by diversifying the portfolio?
To a point, although if you actually look at the layer 3 ASICs inside of it, the early and early ASICs, so there's been a lot of sharing of ASICs across platforms. And sharing of effective hardware code base, you might say.
Silicates ultimately is just the way that you take the layout and you drop it onto the silicon fab.
Yeah.
But Intel chips continue to reuse a lot of, from generation to generation.
Yeah. Well, and to the point, in a niche market, there are very specific items, especially like high-performance trading or things where if you can build an ASIC to create a technical win in a very specific area. But overall differentiation is training supportability, software integration. Mm-hmm. There's a larger value.
Yeah, I just... this is when Cisco doubled down on silicon. We saw the announcement from originally it was at Cisco Live in London in 2012, where they, this manager came up on stage and held up this new chip and everybody just looked at him blankly, right? And that was when it became clear to me that Cisco is going to commit down to manufacturing silicon going forward. Now, that doesn't mean they may not buy merchant silicon for some products.
That's they've already done a little bit of.
Yeah, they've done the converged wireless chip, the one that goes in the 3850, which is the wired wireless for the enterprise campus.
Nexus 3000 switch.
Nexus.
Also.
Yeah.
And those, you're saying 3548, but the next 3000.
But, there's a merchant silicon in the 3000s, but there's also Cisco's got its own chips. They've now got that blade on the 4500, which is converged wireless.
Which moved its way into the
That's right. It's the same chip out of the 3800s going into this thing, right? Cisco's just so big. I mean, we were talking to Cisco the other day, and they were telling us that they've sold $46 billion of Cat 6500s.
Yeah, 800,000 chassis shipped.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, that was when I realized that could be – that's merchant silicon right there because you make enough of them. What's merchant silicon outside of Cisco is the leftovers.
Although, so be aware that Intel leftovers are the primary merchant silicon in the world are Intel chipsets.
Right. And also
and Intel probably have silicon. More switching install base if you count virtual switches.
Right. But if you think about what if Intel starts to put that a piece of a very small switch on the motherboard?
They are.
Exactly.
Well, no. Intel's DPDK libraries, hardware acceleration of OpenV switch, is that – was it the 8147 chipset?
Think so.
I forget the number of it.
I'm not too sure if it's public.
It's publicly released in April.
Okay, it is now. Yep.
So they talked about Open Networking Summit.
So the current version of DPDK is software acceleration by using smarter software pipelines to feed the data into the – network adapters.
Yeah.
And then I believe the next generation will be a multi-port silicon fabric on the motherboard.
And you can do 25 gigabits a second out of a single core right now.
Yeah.
Right. And you and if you look at it, where's the edge of your network? In some cases, the edge is in the physical switch. In some cases, it's in the virtual switch. What you need is a consistent way to implement policy and be able to manage your infrastructure.
Exactly. So here's the software vSwitch will stop being a vSwitch. In other words, it won't be a patch panel. It'll be a networking agent. I call my language is network agent. Just for it's a device in the network. It just happens to be a software agent inside the server.
Yep.
So the question is, I can do that in a hypervisor today, but there's no reason why my Windows NT server can't have a network driver, which is also a network agent.
It will.
Right? It will. Absolutely. Yep. Right? But what I can also choose to do is I can also, in an enterprise environment, which is a little bit different from what we are talking about, but in an enterprise environment, I could have switches which do VXLAN on the port.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the packets come in from my 25-year-old legacy PABX that's got a 10 meg, I can run it straight into a VXLAN tunnel, and then it's attached
to an overlay. Yeah.
And now I have a consistent networking overlay. Yeah. We haven't talked much about overlays, but that's kind of the model where we're going to, right, in enterprise IT. You've got that 10-year-old system over there that you're not going to upgrade the network driver in.
No.
So you can use hardware to put it into a VXLAN tunnel. Once it's in VXLAN, you can then connect it up to your VMware machines using a VXLAN overlay. So now it becomes, how does the software program the hardware VXLAN interface to select which VXLAN ID? Because twiddling your fingers over here and trying to integrate it with the VXLAN tunnel, it's being configured on the VMware server.
You don't twiddle fingers anymore.
No. Well, I mean, that's hard, right?
Right.
That's how do you – because VMware allocates VXLAN IDs autonomously from how you would – in the old days, we controlled it by having a spreadsheet and looking up VLAN IDs, right?
By the way, that's open daylight. So that's the reason for having a shared network compiler.
Yeah.
So the one view that you pull your topology into, and on your podcast, can't see my hands.
Yeah.
Right?
So you can't see Greg's either. They've been going crazy.
Yeah, but you have to have one network compiler, which is your FlowVisor, which is Open Daylight, which has the ability to understand the links, the capabilities, the graph of your network, and implement that policy, whether it's in your vSwitch layer, in your data center, in your access layer. And the one important thing, and I think you can actually look at what Comcast implemented with their OpenStack integrations, is the firewall load balancing, these services layers, these middle boxes. Are, by the way, they're all running it on x86.
Yeah,
so there's no ASIC driven. Some of them have SSL acceleration.
Some of them have some accelerators like SSL crypto processors. And
but even that's being offloaded now, right?
Yeah.
And so since it's all virtual anyways, that what's happening right now is Comcast is doing on the, I believe it's in their network aggregation layer in their POPs, they're hooking OpenStack Quantum, running the virtualized services inside of that.
That's awesome.
And basically connecting in your firewall, your load balancing, your cache acceleration is now a virtualized network component that now, since you already have it in a configured access integrated via software, you can pipe it right into your mesh overlay, however you want to pipe it in.
So the interesting discussion here is if I move my router from a hardware to a software, and I think I've had this discussion in a few different places, is the way to solve the limitations. So we have to recognize that implementing a router or a firewall as a VM in a hypervisor, be it KVM, OpenStack, or vCloud DSX, right, is that we need to have more of them. You have to distribute the load around.
Mm-hmm.
So today we build one big router at the edge because it's cheaper to have one big router and a pair of them in HA than it is to have 200 small ones.
It's only cheaper because humans manage it.
Well, A, and B, because in physical hardware, it's easier to scale vertically than it is to scale horizontally, right? Because then you have the distributed systems problem.
Yeah.
But if I start building 200 virtual routers in software and then apply a software layer, comes back to the continuous delivery song we were singing earlier, right? To orchestrate those 200 routers, then I actually have distributed my processing load around my VM cluster.
And you're applying policy closest to the edge, which is a best practice for networking.
So this is the story there is MPLS's success has been moving the network complexity to the edge and leaving the core simple and easier to administrate. That simplicity meant that risk was removed from the core because you didn't have to worry about, you know, in the old days we used to have TDM circuits and the TDMs had to create keep alives and poll each end. And there was all this call setup and call down. You know, when the ISDN channels would cut across, right? And that meant state was held. And so if the switches rebooted, you lost all the state. This was back before Ethernet, right? So if we could get away from this in our current network cores where we have a pair of...
Here's ISD in mind back then, actually.
We could do ATM if you like. But, you know, today we put in a big pair of switches, big data center class switches, Nexus 7000s, and then they do all the layer 3 routing. But there's only a pair of them. What we really want to do is do the layer 3 right at the edge. So where's the edge? Top of rack?
No,
what about inside the server now?
Right, so in that networking agent, now we can start doing that. But the only way to manage that many, you know, 200
humans can't handle that.
No, it's
got to be automated. Right. It's got to be streamlined, and it's got to be standardized.
Your network device that you manage today, that you log into, is now a library.
Yep.
Which is consumed, compiled, delivered.
Okay, let me ask you a question. How do people get from? You work in an enterprise today, Lauren?
Well, I work for a partner.
So all those customers that you work with today, and we're talking about all this great stuff, you know, software agents in the hypervisors, what do you think it would take for them to deploy that? Like, when are they going to ring you up and say, come and give me an overlay network?
I think it would take us going there and trying to convince them before they called us and asked us to tell them about it. But I live in the Midwest.
The enterprise knows very little about any of what's just happening. In fact, I'm sitting here listening to in the vast array of what we would consider networking. Yeah. You've got service providers. They have one set of problems to solve, and they're providing different sorts of services. Could be just the network. Could be
we're talking inside of a single enterprise customer or single commercial customer.
But even beyond that, you've got a whole different group of enterprises. You've got small, medium-sized businesses, you know, right on up to, you know, larger enterprises in different verticals with different problems to solve and ways that they think about networking, or their IT in general. And they've been doing the same thing for a long time. A lot of these folks are not having these conversations, don't even know what this technology is or even why they need it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the boss is going to say is, why am I going to spend this money?
And if you ask them for SDN, but talk to the vice president of application development.
Yeah.
Talk to the people who make the they're companies that consume.
You're talking about the 1%, I think.
No.
For the most part.
You go into your so people who work in customers. There is almost always one guy who builds that custom web form for their manufacturing line. There is some level of app development, right? Those app development teams that have become modernized are consuming Amazon. They're consuming Azure. They're push button deploying directly to these clouds. They're configuring networks.
But you still have to convince the networking team.
No, you don't. To deploy your app to – so I'm a Microsoft developer, so a Luddite, right? I'm sorry about any Microsoft devs here, but I wanted to deploy to a cloud provider. I have Visual Studio and Team Foundation Server, which Microsoft tells me how to do. I can do a point-click deploy of my .NET applications directly to Azure.
Yeah. All right, so now you're getting into the container debate. So today our atomic element – this is I'm going to get a bit scientific here.
Yeah.
So today our atomic element, right, our indivisible unit is a VM. But what's inside of a virtual machine is an operating system and the application that runs on top of it.
Yep.
And the way that server worlds are going to be upset is that the next generation of software is being developed in PHP what we don't want is a LAMP stack. If all I want to run is a PHP application and a database, why am I using Linux and Apache? Why don't I just give you a container that's got PHP and MySQL in it?
It's known as Cloud Foundry, Heroku. I mean, on the flight over here, Ashley McNamara, and Ryan Adzima, who's runs the networks over at CalArts. We're actually going over and we're showing it was a Node.js application which used for visualization of his networks and his applications. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're going over on GitHub. It's like, oh, you can just deploy it directly to Heroku.
Yeah.
Right?
Bang.
Bang. Done.
So your applications aren't being deployed to a Windows machine or to a Linux machine. They're being deployed to a container, and the container is somewhere. And the container actually connects to the thing somehow.
And we need the network to respond to those containers.
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah.
And or the VM.
Or
so at some point, those containers actually exist in a VM. But what the user actually sees is a container. So one of the projects I'm involved in at the moment is building a PaaS platform as a service.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we actually have developers. And a developer comes along and kicks off a desktop, and they actually get a container in which to install their app, so be it Node or PHP or Java or whatever it is. and they can just push straight into that container. Now, that's the shift that Colin's referring to. But sure. That's even a step further.
Yeah.
Because the trick here is that if you can imagine, I can build a container that contains an entire development environment for a developer to work in. One button, here's his container, here's his desktop, and here's all the toolkits pre-provisioned on here, and here's the server-side toolkits ready to go. And then over here is a production place where he can move his app straight into production. And that gets that developer may never realize that he's using overlay networking mm-hmm. and object-based storage and VMs that are using an operating system because all he sees is a container. He takes his app, pushes his Perl script in, and clicks run. Does he care? Well, he's probably not interested in the operating system.
And you just described, by the way, it's funny. I was at a barbecue with a guy invented Ruby, guy invented OpenStack, and a guy from another routing company, and as well as some other people. And that's actually one of the common implementations, which is Ruby or Rails applications or Node.js on Cloud Foundry on OpenStack. That so abstracts the networking elements away nowadays, where the application teams don't need to talk to the networking team because they get it's consumed through an overlay layer. And that's actually, if you look at how Best Buy
– in other words, there's an underlay network that's already been provisioned and already exists. And so at this point, exists, you can just build a network container that rides on top of that. The underlay network doesn't change. He's just pushing around VXLAN tags or whatever it is, getting tunnel endpoints to talk to one another, which is really what's forming those overlays.
Well,
so
– in very – like a real-world story, Best Buy. So I was out in Minneapolis. I was helping kick off Kyle Mastery, by the way. He works for Cisco CTO Group. Contributed the VXLAN code to OVS. Okay. Works for Lou Tucker on the OpenStack teams. And I was helping him kick off a user group out there. And the couple of guys came out there, and they were continuous delivery consultants. This company's super go faster. And they were helping Best Buy change how they make applications to create them faster. And we're helping them with continuous delivery systems, implementation of people, process, and tools. And so the networking and system teams were not so responsive. And so all they did – these are the developers, by the way. They grabbed 6 servers. They installed OpenStack. And they integrated a cloud platform with their development system. And then they just built those net new applications. And this is in the middle of the frigid north. This is not high tech. This is Minneapolis, right? And this is normal, though. This is your development teams get, and this is part of the DevOps movement, too, that development operations are tight, need to work tightly together with culture, automation, measurement, and sharing.
Hopefully, the sysadmins have something in place where people just aren't having rogue machines everywhere. You know, I mean, I imagine there are a lot of companies where that happens. I'm not saying it's a bad thing that dev takes it on themselves, but
$500,000 of system.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying there are a lot of people that can't get around that in larger businesses.
I've seen some of the self-service provisioning systems. You guys that are deploying them can speak to it, but there tends to be a workflow process where there's an approval and so on that can be done there. So a customer wants to utilize X resource that's there, then there's somebody down the line that may be checking a box, whatever it is, so that can then go ahead and be deployed.
Yeah, so like when OpenStack contributor, right? So I can submit code. It gets automatically evaluated, right? By Jenkins is the open source project that does it, right? Pulls out a Git, a thing called GitHub, pulls into Jenkins, gets evaluated, tested, QA'd, and then actually gets into review process that the PTL or the technical lead and the team responsible for that project. Yes, I want this in production, and then actually it rolls forward and rolls into dailies at Rackspace and into production weekly. That same process on the enterprise side, you know, Cisco bought a company called Klaviyo, and a couple of years ago, a company called NuScale for SIAC, and then another company title. It's actually pretty relevant. I think there's some announcements around Klaviyo going on this week, right?
Yeah, I think there are. I haven't heard much about what they are.
We're supposed to be talking to Klaviyo later in the week. We have a show scheduled with them. So yeah.
So they actually have – is really interesting. So it's FlexPod, vSpecs, vBlock. I've worked with them for quite a few years, and actually the VP of engineering acquired this company, my last company. So Sam Wong's a great guy. It's a self-service IT portal for enterprise virtualization platforms like VMware and Hyper-V and so forth, powered by, on obviously Cisco UCS and Cisco networking components and other storage partners like EMC and NetApp. There's two products inside of it. One of them is Cloud Ignite, which takes all the complex things you do, setting up a FlexPod, a VBlock, or a VSpecs, and you just type in 14 variables because it's a reference architecture. Whatever's unique to you, you type in, and then it makes stuff happen. And then it provides there's Cloud Ignite, and then I forget what they rebranded. It's being rebranded as Cisco UCS Director, I think. Mm-hmm. But then, which is really neat because you're taking the automated, repeatable stuff, templatizing and making, using development tool sets to deploy network topology.
Two things about that. Sorry. One is automation replaces what you do.
Yes, but not who you are.
But that's fine because it frees you up to do something cooler.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Don't think of this as taking away your job. Think of this as an opportunity to upskill into something more interesting.
Yep.
So or alternately, if you think that configuring VLANs and putting IP addresses on interfaces is cool, I'm sorry. It's time to check out McDonald's, right? Because networking's like any career, you have to keep moving up. The burgers at McDonald's get more complicated as years go by, so you have to keep reskilling. It's just the same in networking. That's one step. The second step is that the processes still change. Right? McDonald's doesn't produce the burgers the same way as it did 20 years ago.
It's true.
Right?
Efficiencies,
right?
Yep.
So the second thing is that the automation process is consistent. So even if it's wrong, it'll consistently get it wrong so that you can fix it to make it consistently right. And one of the greatest challenges in networking today is the finger fault. The problem exists between the chair and the keyboard.
Then
human error will be automation. And that means IP addressing comes from a predefined pool. And the software is able to say, this is a bunch of IP addressing space which is allocated for VLANs. I'm just creating a VLAN. I'll get the next one out of that space and drop it on the VLAN. I'll then go through and work out which switches I'll apply, right? In the past, that problem in network provisioning or service provisioning has been extraordinarily complex, and the hours wasted troubleshooting because somebody finger folded a /24 and put a /23 or a /26 or, you know, the wrong gateway address and stood on top of the someone actually was typing .11 and typed .1 and the whole VLAN went out.
Or on the server side, someone dupes the gateway IP and all of a sudden a VLAN's dead in the water.
That's right.
It happens the other way too.
So this is about improving service overall. Those automation processes might replace the way you're doing things, but equally it should free you up to do something cool.
Either that or compliance, which would be really boring.
Well, no, there's
you can free it up to do compliance.
You can do compliance in the same way. You could use automation to achieve compliance.
True.
Now, in a perfect world, you would actually find ways to do the automation yourself, right? So instead of sitting down, and this is where you'll hear me probably go on for months about chin up, chin down.
Yeah.
Up until now, networking people have been chin down, configuring VLANs and typing IP addresses and troubleshooting because they mistyped something or because the VLAN's in the wrong place or the spanning tree doesn't, you know, the VLAN trunk doesn't have that VLAN on it, so it's not on the right. And then the person did it on the primary but not on the secondary, right? Well, hopefully that will all be automated out. There's no value there to the business in that. Mm-hmm. So what it should free you up to do is to walk around auditing. So physical audits, how many servers, where did they come from? Did somebody plug something in when I wasn't looking? What's my cabling looking like? Security audits where you can say, give me a list of every server in the data center and it's accurate. And you go, what is this one for? You know, this server needs to be replaced, this switch. And predicting 6 months out that this switch needs a software upgrade, you should now have time to work on this.
I think there's a more important point to this, and there's a shift in IT operations and technology that we're in the DevOps movement encompasses this to a point that IT operators are moving back into information versus infrastructure and understanding that there's the goals of the business. It may be we're going to launch a new manufacturing plant to get a product to market, or we're going to launch a new application. And how can I, inside of the technology group, understand the goals of my business and accelerate those goals? And there are brilliant minds are out here, you know, 17,000 people at Cisco Live that have more to add to their businesses than configuring a route switch port. And that to be able to accelerate their ability of their business to make money and compete, or if you're in the government space, to provide services to your community, right? And that is so much more valuable. But it does require, you know, I'm a CCIE myself, and a director in the business who, you know, hires a lot. The latest architects I've been hiring are developers. Right. They have Python skills. They have Puppet skills. They have Chef skills. They understand how to interact with the new customer. They understand how to automate the boring and mundane tasks. And even now going through value stream mapping exercises with engineers as they come on to teaching them Lean and Six Sigma techniques of how to map in a process of deploying an infrastructure and application and use their brains to make that more efficient.
Yeah. And what I want to say is, like, if you find yourself sitting there doing a task that you don't like, think how you can automate it. And that's what you, and that's what the goal of this is. Like, oh, I've got 20 VLANs to add and this and that, and they're all going to be pretty identical except for description, name, and a few other things. Mm-hmm. Like, a script should be generating that, for example.
Or use it to study. Like, so ID Analytics, right? So I ran the operations team as a network architect there, peer to the software architect. I had automated my entire job. We did millions of transactions a day, integrated with all the banks, whatnot, got acquired by LifeLock. Thank you. I appreciate the check. I was able to study, got most of my CCI study out because I had automated the day-to-day job.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, they didn't tell anyone, but it was awesome. And was I providing value? Was I making sure that, because if that we would get paid on transactions, that we were launching customers quickly? Absolutely. But I was able to find time to learn more and actually provide more value.
Yeah.
Another thing that Colin said that I think was pretty key is, if you're a network engineer who doesn't understand the business that you're working for and what services you deliver, you're really missing a trick. There's something important there that you can add a lot more value to the place that you're employed by if you understand what they do for work, if you understand the applications that are most important to making that business function, if you know what data is going in and out of your data center. If you're just a plumber, you're really missing it. You know, yeah, to follow up on what Greg was saying, if you think typing VLAN numbers in and provisioning interfaces, ooh, it's up at gigabit full, I'm excited, and there's no input errors, woo! That was the biggest, the most exciting thing that happened in your day sucked, you know? Really, get involved in what the point, what's going through the pipes, get some clue.
Take it one step further, right? When I deploy a server in the network, the firewall rules should be done at the same time.
Absolutely. Right. Consistently.
You know, it's not just about lighting up a networking port. It's about adding the firewall. What about the load balance?
And having a test to make sure it functions.
Yeah.
And continues functioning.
Yeah. And review later. And if it ever gets out of sync, you should know about it.
So you should, as a network.
Yeah.
And you should be able to, as a network engineer, as parts of your applications go to Amazon and others, provide that same visibility of how to create highly available, highly secure, auditable infrastructure.
Yep.
And help your teams design anywhere.
That's not Excel, by the way.
Sorry.
I guess I would just ask, a lot of people from my generation haven't really been coding a lot. You know, the network admins and network engineers, we've kind of gotten away with that for a while. So what do you do to get back into that? I mean, what are some things that you guys would recommend? Some solicited and unsolicited advice, I guess.
I guess there's a couple of things in there. One is, you might want to start, if you've never done any programming, do some fundamentals first. So in the same way that in networking, one of the mistakes that people say is, why don't you just go and learn how to write a Python script? That's actually kind of not good advice, because that's saying, why don't you just go and build a firewall and a network? Because there's certain fundamentals you need to know to be able to write a script. You need to know the difference between a compiled and a script. You need to understand different types of sorts. You need to be able to understand concepts of arrays and how to slice an array to extract a data field from it.
Like a codeacademy.com type of thing.
I actually have a good one that's really relevant. I know you try to do a lot for women in IT. Hackbright Academy is a 10-week programmer's course focused at females in technology, and they don't actually have to be in technology. They actually have scholarships. There's Rocket Space, which is a 10-week code academy, too, that you can go into. I personally love the Learning Puppet VMs are very IT operations focused. Mm-hmm. You can just 5 minutes at a day.
Yeah.
Puppet is awesome for IT guys. And then my wife, she's made automation packages for Photoshop. She actually open sourced it in a thing called OpenChimp. But she's been learning Python, and she kind of went out to the community. And Python for Kids is actually a great book.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So those are very practical examples. Yeah. But what I wanted to do is encourage people to get out there and pick up some fundamentals as well as a language. So if you want to pick a language, pick Python. I'm a personal fan of JavaScript because I think JavaScript will play a bigger role.
Yeah, I think that's interesting too. I mean, back in the day, you know, we learned C or something. Like now it seems like there's so much out there.
But the principles, the fundamentals of programming are – you learn C, you had to learn very solid programming fundamentals to successfully generate C code, get it compiled, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know, that doesn't take anything away from
you. Need to understand the difference between C and Python and JavaScript. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But interpreted languages are order of magnitude easier than C.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, C's a rough place to start for sure.
Yes. I remember first year college and, you know, memory management and all that fun stuff in C and memory leaks. And oh, I didn't do Pascal. I missed out on that.
You must be younger.
Yeah, but my point is done. Yeah, so the point I was trying to make, which is just, you know, there's fundamentals. And that doesn't matter which language you learn. Mm-hmm. And in fact, over time, you need to understand that in terms of programming, today's language, Python, is popular. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, it might be JavaScript.
Shift around.
And in 5 years' time, it might move a bit further. You know, languages like Perl 10 years ago were hugely popular, and today they're static. They're still in use. Many people use them, but...
Actually, Stephen Iverson blogged a bunch of fundamentals of programming, operators and looping structures and so on packetpushers.net. You can get into if you go to packetpushers.net and search for programming, you're going to bring up some of his blog posts.
Oh, yeah, there was like a 3 or 4 part series on that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he put a lot of time into those and they were very good.
One thing that I found very valuable with getting into modern software development, actually contributing to an open source project, it's open, so opened my eyes to continuous delivery systems, right? Mm-hmm. Working with distributed teams, modern software project management methodologies like Scrum and Kanban. Mm-hmm. There's the technical aspects of writing code.
Oh, the biggest challenge for me is learning how to do unit testing.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, when I went to university, they just taught you how to write code.
No, you test, you write a test as well as your feature now.
That's exactly, yeah.
This, I mean, it blew my freaking mind.
I mean, yeah. I sort of say,
mind blown.
The idea that you actually, you know, you write your program and then you write a testing suite for it as you write that.
Yeah.
And so if you're, and then you make a change, and then you run the testing program to make sure it actually stayed sane. Mm-hmm. That's a complete innovation compared to where.
Well, do you only test it on your computer? Do you test it other places?
No, you actually write multiple tests. Mm-hmm. You write a local test on your laptop. You then those CI systems, continuous integration delivery systems like Jenkins I talked about.
Yeah.
When your application runs on your network, and your network may be the application, by the way, this is part of the SDN. That test that you wrote for that feature now gets run every single time another feature gets put in the application. Your network. And so now you catch the fault in QA, you catch it in your testing system before you catch it in production. So your quality of the code comes up. There's important things like test coverage now becomes important to you, right?
And so the idea behind continuous testing, which is what you're leading to ultimately, is that you every time you write, add a new module. So let's say you've written a suite which does an audit using a program. You should have a test sitting next to it that runs through the software and tests all of the variables and all the things that are in the suite. Mm-hmm. So that when you go along and add a new function, you run the unit testing and you go, this is fit for purpose and deploy because everything's tested. Mm-hmm. It's not because you don't have any – and it catches the unexpected.
You also find things like, you know, performance regressions and lots of things and during those stages.
Yeah, you find memory leaks or code bugs.
That stuff.
You shift from Perl – you know, you shift from Python this to Python that and you compile it and you run your test suite in that new environment. All of a sudden you realize that this point version of code doesn't work the way the previous one does.
Yeah.
All those things get caught in the unit testing or the continuous testing field, and that's the change, right? All right, so I'm going to pretty abruptly run this out because we've gotten to the time limit and we have to get something out the door, Mr. Banks.
We do indeed.
So I think we'll call that a wrap for this week, and thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Cooper, please tell people where you can find you.
Cooperlees.com/blog. I've been very lazy with it lately, but I think I'm going to pick it back up. At Cooperlees on Twitter, and I'm always around the Bay Area, keen for a drink.
And good to see a man from Australia, buddy.
Thanks.
Nice. Oh, thanks for coming on and catching
up. Ladies, Cooper's on the market, just so you know.
He's got a cute
650
accent.
650. No.
Apparently girls in the Bay Area dig the accent, right?
Bay Area's not as good as other parts of America because there's too many Aussies there. But in other parts of America, the accent does okay.
Works a treat here in Orlando, I've heard.
That's rumors, Mr. Banks, rumors.
There's a good volleyball tournament in town.
Yeah.
60,000.
Lauren.
I'm Lauren Malhoit at Malhoit, M-A-L-H-O-I-T. I live in Indianapolis and be here the rest of the week in Orlando for Cisco Live and then back to the daily grind.
And where can people find your podcast?
Adapting IT. It's adaptingit.com, and you can go there. You can get it on iTunes or get it off the direct feed and keep listening. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Awesome.
Colin?
So Colin McNamara on colinmcnamara.com and at Colin McNamara on Twitter. You can find me. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm all around the United States and the world. Most active at OpenStack user groups. So you can find me at any of your meetups.
Mr. Banks, I'm not going to ask you what's in the week ahead because you're going to be swamp ass on your way around Orlando.
That's right.
I'll be doing exactly that, rowing a boat through the humidity back and forth from the hotel to this room where we're recording.
That's it. Well, we'll make a point of hiding out in the social media clubhouse so I don't have to think about any of that. I don't want to get a mental picture going on that.
That's right. Any mental pictures that I can't resist sharing will be found on Twitter at EC Banks. And of course, I'll be blogging at networkcomputing.com and packetpushers.net.
Your personal blog?
Oh, my personal blog, which I haven't really talked about much, but I'm trying to ramp it up, is ethancbanks.com. I'm studying for CCDE, the Cisco Certified Design Expert, and just getting that study process started. And I think I'm going to put most of my content related to CCDE up there. There's so many unique and weird little posts that are going to come up as I prepare for that cert. I don't really feel it belongs on Packet Pushers exactly. So my personal blog is where that stuff's going to end up, ethancbanks.com.
Okay. I promise not to eat deep fried pancakes every day this week.
Yeah, we only missed today, but on accident. Today,
but that, you know, well, we needed to hustle it along, but tomorrow it's going to be those deep fried pancakes happening at Denny's because they were evil. A little heart attack in a ball, sort of thing.
It's pancake batter. They roll into a ball and deep fry it and then serve it with sugar. It's a dipping sugar.
Is that called a beignet?
I don't know what it's
kinda
called.
Yeah.
That's a beignet.
I just call it yum.
They call it a pancake puppy.
I'd like to see a deep fried mustard, maybe.
Oh! Somebody just go to the urinal. I'll go to the urinal. You probably don't have those.
So I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter is at etherealmind. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net. Leave a comment on today's show or follow us on the Twitter is @packetpushers. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.